Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Our mission, as always, is to give you that core intelligence you need, you know, cutting through all the hype and the noise.
And today, we're really getting into the weeds. We're looking at the architecture of decentralized finance, specifically lending protocols.
Which is so fundamental.
It really is. I mean, if you're in DeFi at all, you're using these protocols, maybe without even realizing it. We're talking about the engine that lets people borrow and lend money globally, instantly, and this is the key, with no credit scores.
And that's the hook, right? It feels like a paradox. How can you possibly build trust? How can you guarantee a loan gets repaid when you have totally permissionless access? You know nothing about the borrower.
Well, the system solves that paradox by basically throwing out the whole idea of identity and credit history.
Right.
It replaces it with pure, cold, hard math.
Collateral.
That's why the one concept to grasp today is over-collateralization. To get a loan, you have to lock up assets that are worth significantly more than the money you're borrowing.
It just completely flips the script from, you know, a traditional bank. They look at your past behavior to predict your future. Here, the protocol just makes sure it has enough of your stuff to cover the debt if you default, no questions asked.
Precisely.
Okay, so let's unpack that. This idea of managing trust with assets, not identity, it's really the bedrock of the whole system. Can you walk us through a really simple example of over-collateralization?
Sure. Let's use some easy numbers. Say you want to borrow $100 worth of a stablecoin, like USDC.
Okay.
The protocol might require you to deposit, say, $150 worth of a more volatile asset. Ether, or ETH, is a common one.
And that extra 50 bucks, that's the key.
It's everything. It's not a fee. It's the protocol's safety buffer. It's what protects the person on the other side, the lender, from the price of your ETH suddenly crashing.
So I'm locking up my $150 of ETH to get my hands on $100 of cash I can actually use. It's like a credit line, but it's secured entirely by assets I already have. I'm not borrowing against future me, I'm borrowing against present me.
Exactly. And for the whole system to work, for lenders to trust it, there are basically three steps that have to run like clockwork. First, you deposit your collateral, the 150 in ETH.
Step one, done.
Step two, you borrow the debt, the 100 in USDC. But the third step is the most critical one, and it's all about what happens if your collateral's value changes.
Right, because ETH isn't stable.
Not at all. Okay. And if the value of your ETH collateral falls and gets too close to that $100 debt, the smart contract, it doesn't wait. It doesn't ask for permission. It automatically triggers a liquidation.
And that word automatic is just, it's so important here. In the old world, you know, TradFi, if your account gets shaky, you get a margin call. A person calls you, you get a warning.
You might get a few days to add more funds.
Yeah. Here it's just code. It's instant. Algorithmic.
That's what makes the permissionless part possible. Because the risk is managed by code, the protocol doesn't care who you are. It doesn't need to. Your access to capital is immediate, it's global, and it's based only on the math of your collateral. If you fail to keep that buffer, the system uses your collateral to pay back the loan right away.
So the loan is always, always secured.
Always.
Okay, so that groundwork on automated trust is crucial. But as a user, you know, you can't just trust the system blindly. You need to see where you stand. You need a way to monitor your own safety margin.
Yes.
So let's talk about the one number, the one metric on your dashboard that really decides whether you survive or not. The health factor.
The health factor. You can think of it as your loan's heartbeat. Okay. It's a single number that tells you right now, are you safe? Or are you standing on the edge of a cliff about to be liquidated?
If you're going to do anything in DeFi lending, you have to watch this number.
It's non-negotiable.
So before we get to the formula, we should probably clear something up. People hear loan-to-value or LTV, and they hear liquidation threshold. They sound kind of similar.
They do, and it's a really key distinction. They govern two totally different things. The LTV is your initial limit.
The starting line.
Right. If a protocol has an LTV of, say, 80%, that means right at the start, you can borrow up to 80% of your collateral's value. Mm-hmm. It's your borrowing ceiling when you open the position.
Got it. So LTV is where the loan begins. So where does the liquidation threshold come in?
The liquidation threshold is the safety tripwire. It's the point of no return. It's the percentage that your debt can reach before the system says, okay, time's up, and sells your collateral. And crucially, it's always higher than the LTV.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So if the LTV is 80%, the threshold might be 85 or even 90%. It gives you and the protocol a little bit of a buffer zone. It stops, you know, a tiny sudden price whoop-wick from just instantly wiping you out.
And this all rolls up into that formula for the health factor. Let's state that formula clearly because it is so central to this whole thing.
Okay, so the health factor is calculated like this. You take the total value of your collateral, you multiply it by the liquidation threshold, and then you divide that whole thing by the value of your debt.
So if that calculation spits out a number that's greater than one, you're good, you're safe.
You're safe. It means your collateral value, with that little buffer from the threshold, is still bigger than what you owe.
But the second, the very second, it dips below one.
Liquidation begins. You are, in the eyes of the smart contract, insolvent. And that happens when your collateral, the asset you deposited, drops in value so much that the top part of that fraction becomes smaller than the bottom part.
Wow. It's just a brutally efficient relationship between price and safety. And just to put a pin in this, we're talking about the risk side, but what about the cost, the interest rates? That's handled completely separately, right?
Totally separate. Yeah, interest rates are just pure supply and demand, all done by algorithm. If tons of people want to borrow ETH from a pool, the interest rate for borrowing ETH goes up. That encourages more people to lend their ETH. There's no committee, no Fed meeting. It's just the protocol's utilization ratio.
Okay, so the risks are pretty clear. The volatility of your collateral is basically your main enemy. But given that you have to lock up so much more than you borrow, why do people even do this? Our sources seem to point to three main strategies where this is actually a really powerful tool.
It is. And the first one, probably the most common, is leverage.
Right.
But the kind of leverage you can get in DeFi is often so much faster and more seamless than in traditional finance.
So leverage, in simple terms, is just amplifying your bet. You put in asset A, say ETH, you borrow asset B, maybe a stablecoin, and then you immediately use that stablecoin to buy more ETH.
Yes, you're creating a loop. What's so powerful is the lack of friction. To get a margin account in TradFi, there's paperwork, there's verification. In DeFi, you can do this whole borrow and rebuy loop in minutes.
Yeah.
Globally, 24/7.
Which lets you jump on market opportunities instantly.
Instantly. Mm. You can increase your potential gains like crazy if you're right and the price goes up. But, and it's a huge, and it also turbocharges your risk. Because if the price goes down, your collateral value is shrinking fast while your debt is staying the same, which sends your health factor straight down.
That's where people get wrecked, as they say. Okay, so that's leverage. The second strategy is, I think, really interesting for long-term holders, tax efficiency.
This is a massive advantage. I mean, imagine you're sitting on a lot of Bitcoin or something similar, and it's got up a ton over the last few years.
Right.
Now you need, say, $50,000 for a down payment on a house. If you sell your Bitcoin to get that cash, that is an immediate and probably very large capital gains tax event.
A huge tax bill. But with DeFi, you could just deposit that Bitcoin as collateral and borrow the $50,000 in stablecoins you need.
And you get the liquidity without selling. That is the key insight. You've basically created a credit line against an asset that was otherwise just sitting there. You get your cash for the short term, but you keep your long-term position and you put off paying that capital gains tax. That's something that's almost impossible for a regular person to do in the traditional world.
So that speed and lack of red tape is the edge in both cases. What about the third one, short selling?
Short selling is just betting an asset's price is going to fall. In DeFi, you just borrow that asset, you sell it right away for stablecoins, and you wait. If the price drops like you thought it would,
buy it back for cheaper.
You buy back for cheaper, you return the loan, and you keep the difference.
So if I think, let's call it G token, is way overvalued at $10, I could borrow 100 of them, sell them for 1,000 USDC. If G token crashes to $5, I buy the 100 tokens back for $500, pay back my loan, and I've just made $500 minus my borrowing fees.
That's the play. But remember, to borrow that $1,000 worth of G tokens, you still had to put up significant collateral, maybe $1,500 worth of ETH. And if you're wrong, if G token goes up instead of down, you're now forced to buy an even more expensive asset to repay your debt. It's a high-risk play. All three of these demand, you know, that health factor inside and out.
Okay, we absolutely need to make this tangible. For anyone listening who's thinking about this, avoiding liquidation means you have to understand the math, not just the concept. So let's run a stress test.
Let's do it. We'll set some parameters you'd see in a typical protocol. Let's assume a fixed liquidation threshold of 115%.
Okay, 115. So that means my collateral value times 1.1 fiend has to stay higher than my debt.
Correct. So let's use our original numbers. We have $150 of ETH as collateral.
Got it. 150 collateral.
We have $100 of USDC as our debt, which is fixed.
Okay.
And our liquidation threshold is 1.15. So what's our starting health factor?
Let's see. So we do 150 times 1.15 and then divide that by the debt, which is 100.
And that gives you 172.50 divided by 100. So your starting health factor is 1.725.
1.725. That feels really safe.
It is. You have a very healthy buffer there. But as we said, markets are volatile. So let's run the stress test. What if the price of ETH drops and our collateral value falls by, say, 25%?
Sure.
Our 150 in ETH is now only worth $112.50.
Oh, wow. Okay.
This is where the math starts to bite. Your collateral is down, but your debt is still $100. Let's run the calculation again.
So 112.50 times 1.15, all divided by 100.
Which gives you 129.375 over 100. So your new health factor is about 1.29. You're still safe, but look at what happened.
I've burned through almost half my safety buffer. I went from 1.725 all the way down to 1.29. The margin of error is shrinking fast.
Yes.
So that drop felt bad, but the position is still alive. The real question is, what is the absolute floor? What is the minimum collateral value I can have before the system just sells me out? Where does HF equal exactly 1?
Okay, so for the health factor to equal 1, the top of the fraction has to equal the bottom. So your collateral times 1.15 has to equal your $100 of debt.
Right.
So if you divide 100 by 1.15, you find the answer. The collateral has to drop all the way to $86.96.
$86.96. That's the cliff. If my $150 of ETH drops to that value, I'm liquidated. So that's a total drop of, what, about 42%?
About 42%. And that 42% collapse,
yeah,
that's the real risk metric you need to be thinking about when you open one of these positions. You aren't really managing the market price. You're managing how close that price is to your personal liquidation cliff.
Which is why in a big market crash, you hear about these massive cascades of liquidations.
Exactly. It's just millions of smart contracts all doing this exact calculation per second, finding every position that just slipped below one, and automatically selling the collateral to make the lenders whole.
It's ruthless, but it keeps the protocol solvent. The lesson seems really clear. No matter which strategy you're using, leverage, tax efficiency, shorting, it all comes down to how well you manage your distance from that liquidation threshold.
That's the entire game.
Well, this has been a really comprehensive picture of the mechanics that let this whole permissionless world work. Let's just quickly nail down the 5 key takeaways for everyone.
Okay. First, access is based entirely on over-collateralization. Forget credit scores. Second, the system safety net is automatic liquidations, all run by code.
Right. Third, the health factor is your lifeline. You have to keep it above 1.
Fourth, remember, it's the liquidation threshold, not the initial LTV, that defines your real danger point.
And finally, number 5, the interest rates are all algorithmic, driven purely by supply and demand in the protocol.
And, you know, today we really focused on the risk of your collateral, the volatile asset, right? The ETH side of the equation.
Yeah, we've kind of been assuming that the other side, the debt side, the USDC you borrowed, just stays stable, that it's always worth $1.
And that assumption, that stability, it's taken for granted in the health factor calculation. But it's really the second sort of hidden foundational pillar of this entire ecosystem.
Which leads us perfectly to our final provocative thought for you to take away. If the safety of this whole system and your own personal loan depends on those stable assets actually staying stable, how is that $1 peg actually maintained? What happens to the whole market when those complicated stability mechanisms fail and that $1 assumption suddenly turns out to be false? That is the next great question to explore on your journey.